This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Anne Neva is our guest this afternoon. She is a journalist who covers wars. What motivates her to do this work? Well, she says she wants us to hear the voices from under the ruins. She wants us to know something of the struggles of the people living amidst the death and destruction of war. Anne Neva is the author of The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan. The book was published this fall in paperback with a new introduction by the author. For the hardcover book, first published in France in 2004, she spent 12 weeks at a stretch traveling north to south in each country, living among the people and conducting hundreds of interviews. In the fall and winter of 2005-2006, she returned to revisit some of the people she had interviewed earlier. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Anne Neva is an award-winning journalist and author. She earned a doctorate in political science from the Institut d'Études Politiques of Paris, and she was a Fulbright Fellow at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard University. She speaks French, English, and Russian. She is the author of three books, including Chien de Guerre, A Woman Reporter Behind the Lines of the War in Chechnya. Her book, The Wake of War, is now available in paperback from the Beacon Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Anne Neva joins us this afternoon by telephone from Paris. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello, good afternoon.
Hello. What led you to journalism?
Well, it's nothing. It's just because I wanted to understand how do people live. You know, for me, journalism is just by curiosity. It's being curious, being and staying curious. It's about sharing the lives of the people I'm interested in understanding. And because I live in the West, because I grew up in the West, and because I think that there is such a growing gap between the people who live in the West like me and them and the others, those who live outside of this sort of bubble, I really wanted to be able to go visit them, not only visit them, but stay some time and blend in, literally blend in into the population, and to try to come back and convey to my readers how do they live. And by understanding how do they live, I could also try to illustrate how do they see us. Because I think in order for us to understand them and to understand how we can all live together, we have to understand what is their vision of us.
Mm. How do you do your work? How do you blend in?
Well, I started to do that, I would say, almost naturally, without any efforts, during the war in Chechnya. The war in Chechnya, which is still going on, was my first war. I was then based in Moscow. I was based in Moscow for 10 years in a row. And when the second war started in Chechnya, which was in 1999, I decided to go there, and I spent a lot of time during the peak of the war, during the peak of the military campaign, inside Chechnya, with no possibilities, in fact, to leave Chechnya, because once you are in, and then you are under the bombs, and you live with the civilians, well, what can you do? You can't go back to Moscow. You can't leave the place. So you have to stay to continue your work. And that's how I decided to, first of all, get dressed like the other Chechen woman. That's for me very important. In order not to get too much attention, I decided just to be dressed like them, which means also to wear a scarf if needed. And also it means also to live with the people. Of course, you, in Chechnya during the war, you had no hotels. So I was obliged to stay at the people's homes, and that's what I did. And then I decided, after this experience in Chechnya, to do the same, to continue, to keep doing the same in other countries, such as Iraq and Afghanistan.
Hmm. How do you approach someone for an interview?
Well, for me, what we call interviews is not really an interview. It's not me coming, approaching them, asking them for an interview. It's me living with them, and them knowing that I'm writing a book and discussing with me. And in fact, I learn a lot about them by interviewing them, by having this discussion. But they do also learn a lot about me and about our world and about the West. So it's sort of mutual. And I think that kind of attitude is something that makes it a little bit slightly different from more classical journalists who had been sent by a television, by a newspaper, to the field only for a few days, and that kind of journalist. Usually they stay together in hotels for journalists in the so-called green zone in Baghdad, for example. That's absolutely not what I do. I'm not against. I mean, there are many kinds of journalists, and there is room for all of us, but. But I like doing it, and I would like to keep doing it because it is doable. I don't want the public opinion to think that it is not doable. It is always doable to go by yourself. Well, I'm not by, when I say by myself, it just means that I'm alone. I don't have with me translators, drivers, etc. I always find them on the spot. And I am driven by my instinct, in fact. So I don't have a deadline in time. I can stay 1, 2, 3 days with the family, but I can also stay 2 weeks if I want, if I think that they have a story, that this is my story.
So you just let things
happen.
Happen.
Exactly. And usually people are very happy to have me with them at home, because they understand that I'm not in a hurry. They understand that I'm deeply interested in them, and not only in what's happening to them, but also in them, really, in their way of living, in what we eat at home, what they cook for me, in what they read, what is their environment. Mm-hmm. I need to stay some time in each family to understand the family ties, it's so different from our world, from the Western world. I have met, and I have myself felt so many things in those countries that we have forgotten here in the West, such as the solidarity between people, the hospitality. Hospitality is a great thing, a great value. Humility also, and that is something that I really try to keep to illustrate in my books, in my stories, because I think that is only through that kind of story, through that kind of description of their environment, that we will be able to understand really what is happening. News and hot news is not sufficient. We have to go beyond that, beyond the surface of the permanent information.
One of the things that struck me about the stories in the wake of war is the detail that you provide us, not only what people are doing at mealtime, but where they're getting their news, what their hopes and dreams are for themselves and for their families.
Absolutely. You're right. And in fact, I've been writing about the same in each country. I mean, no matter where I am, in Moscow, in Siberia, in Chechnya, or in Iraq, or in Afghanistan, or in Pakistan, I'm always interested in the same. What do the people dream of? What are they afraid of? How do they see themselves in a few years? What would they like for their children? Because by answering those questions, by asking them those questions, you get a real answer, an answer which is much closer to the reality, to their sincerity. What I'm obsessed with, in fact, is sincerity, authenticity, which is, to say the least, the opposite of the sort of staged information we unfortunately get too often, to my point of view. And in order to escape that, in order to try to address issues differently, I think my way to do it is just to spend some more time. I think everything, the key thing is in the time I spend on the spot, in the field, with those people. And I'm not obsessed with meeting with high-ranking people or officials. I leave that to other journalists, because that's usually, you know, when you, for example, if you are sent to Iraq now, to Baghdad, where will you go? You go to the Green Dome, you will try to interview some officials there, or the U.S. Army or whatever. I decided not to do that because it has been done, and because I think we need the other side of the story, the side of the people. That is what is missing today. What is missing is to smell, to feel, what is it like to live in Baghdad today on a daily basis.
Mm. I want to talk about Baghdad today and when you visited, but I want to go back to one of the first people we meet in your book, who is a Kurdish man, and
right.
His name is, correct my pronunciation if it is
Bilal.
Wrong, Bilal.
Yes.
Would you tell us about him and his family?
Well, Bilal is a Kurd, so he lives in northern Iraq, Kurdistan, and he's a young man. He is in his early 20s. And in fact, I met him because, you know, that's also one other thing in my books. In the book you mentioned, The Wake of War, I went to Iraq and to Afghanistan before that, so I'm always sort of following my friends, my interviewees. When I meet them one time, I always try to meet them again, and try to understand what happened to them in between. So Bilal is from a very humble family, almost poor family, I would say. He was quite shocked when I told him that I had no intention to leave, to stay in a hotel during my stay in Erbil, which is the big city of Kurdistan where I met him. I wanted to stay in his house, and he was quite ashamed, I remember, the first day to bring me to his house, because it was a mud house in the outskirts of Erbil, and with no heating. And but I'm used to that, and I made him understand that I could handle it, that it was not a problem, because he saw me as a Westerner coming from, you know, a young woman, that I would need some more comfort or whatever. But I had to explain to him that that was part of my job, the way I walk, to try to understand how he lives. So he eventually understood, and he brought me inside his family, and I met with his father, I met with his mother, with all the sisters. Now his father died, and I saw him again. Last time I saw him was last fall, and I must say that Bilal he speaks a little English, and he was from time to time working as a translator for the U.S. Army, and he told me many stories about the U.S. Army, about his hopes that the U.S. military presence in Iraq and specifically in Kurdistan would also help to improve the situation in Kurdistan. And but he is now very, very disappointed by what is happening in Iraq today. And I think that is also a sign that is terrible, terrifying sign, very saddening sign of when I meet with the people I encountered a few years ago, I meet again with them, and what they tell me is very negative. What they tell me is, well, if 2 years ago they could at least see themselves continue living in Iraq, have a future, a bright future in Iraq. Now, even Bilal, a real patriot, wants to leave. He wants to leave his country. Now, of course, his father died, so he will have, because according to the family values and traditions, he cannot leave because he is the eldest son, so he has to take care of the family. But it's very difficult for him to take care of the family, so he's jumping from job to job, and nothing is for sure, even in northern Iraq.
Yeah. One of the themes that comes across to me in this account is whether or not one should leave one's country.
You mean if he should leave his country?
Well, he has a brother who left.
Yes, exactly. And a brother who left and who is in the UK and who works in a kitchen, in a restaurant. And he is, in fact, quite divided about the fact that his brother left. He is at the same time proud to have a brother in London and to be able to call him and to give him news of the family and to receive some money from the brother. Of course, not much, but some money. And proud, but at the same time, he also understands that his brother is not doing great in the UK. The brother, of course, as I understand, because I didn't speak with the brother, but the brother did not explain to him all the difficulties of being an immigrant in Europe. He ended up in the UK after a long travel, of course, throughout Europe with many problems everywhere. And he is illegally, of course, in the UK. So it might not last. Mm. But Bilal studied more than his brother, and he would like to go outside to continue his studies. He's like every young Iraqi. He's watching TV all the time, satellite TV, and he has all the TV channels in English. And most of them, they learn English by watching TV.
Very interesting. Well, I bring up the point of exile and of refugees because this is part of the story now in Iraq. So many people leaving, those who are able. One of the people that you met in Kirkuk.
Yes, Nilet, this woman.
Yes.
Yeah, she is absolutely fantastic. She's a teacher of English language, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's in Kirkuk. And what I didn't mention in this book, The Wake of War, because since The Wake of War, I went back to Iraq, and I saw Nidret again, and I just published in France another small book about that, which is called, the title is Islamists, How Do They See Us? Because, again, that's their vision on us. I saw Nidret again, and Nidret, who teaches English, told me something very sad, which is that her students at school in Kirkuk, they now ask her, why do you teach us English? We don't want to learn English anymore because English is the language of the enemy. English is the language of the occupier. And I must say that is a sign, of course, a bad sign, a sign that the situation is getting worse and worse because Nidret, as Nidret told me after I saw her for the Wake of War, the second time when I recently saw her, she also wants to leave, and she could leave because she is, ethnically, she is neither Kurd nor Arab. She is Turkoman, which is the third biggest ethnic in Iraq. And so her language is almost Turkish language. So she speaks Arabic, she speaks Turkish, and she could leave to Turkey, of course. And she has, for example, she gave me the example of her son. She has a son who is a student, and she doesn't want him to go and study in Baghdad, a few hundred kilometers south of Kirkuk, because she thinks Baghdad is too dangerous, and I don't blame her. Of course, it's very dangerous, but she doesn't want her son to go and study in Istanbul in Turkey, her father, her husband, his father would like the son to go and study in Turkey, but the mother, Nidret, she thinks that if the son will go to study in Istanbul, he will never come back. And she doesn't want him never to come back because she doesn't want him, she told me that if he leaves as a Turkman, he will be replaced by a Kurd or an Arab. And she thinks, and that's a good lesson. I mean, Iraq is a pluri-ethnical country.
Mm-hmm.
And Nidret is also a patriot. She thinks that the Turkmens should have something to say regarding, you know, Iraqi's affair. But unfortunately, that's not the case, because the battle that is going on right now in Baghdad doesn't include the Turkmens. And the result is that in Kirkuk, it's total chaos in Kirkuk. And I'm afraid that it might be even worse than Baghdad very soon, because Kirkuk is a big city with a lot of oil. And who wants the oil? The Arabs want the oil, the Kurds want the oil, and now, of course, the Turkmens want the oil. And the U.S. military soldiers who are based there, they decided absolutely not to get involved into that kind of problems in between the communities, the sectarian problems. That's the problem of Iraq today, the sectarian problem.
Mm. Taken together, north to south, all these people, all these stories, what do these stories tell us in general about how the U.S. is seen in Iraq?
The U.S. is seen, unfortunately, very negatively. Very negatively for the first obvious reason, which is so obvious, but it has to be mentioned, because it is just the occupation, the military occupation. When you live in a country under military occupation, you cannot feel comfortable. I can give you the example of Chechnya, and I went back to Chechnya recently. Chechnya is occupied by Russian soldiers, and all the Chechens say the same. You cannot live and feel comfortable and have a normal life under occupation, under military occupation. It's everything it gets difficult to go from your village to the capital to another village, to go to do your shopping, to do anything gets difficult because of the occupation, because of the danger of the occupation. So now in Iraq, so that's the first thing. Secondly, what they see of the U.S. soldiers in their own country is only negative also. For example, I remember, I saw that by myself, but for example, when you're in Baghdad, or when you drive with your car from Baghdad to any other city or throughout any other city, you see the U.S. military convoys. And at the end of the military convoy, at the last car, military car, there is a big sign which reads in big letters in English. First of all, they wrote it only in English. Can you imagine? No one understands English in Iraq. So, I mean, the average Iraqi doesn't understand English. But now at least the signs are written in English and in Arabic, and the sign says, be careful, don't approach the last car. If you approach, I will shoot. So, of course, that's very complicated for the Iraqi people to be taught and to be told in their own city how they should drive inside this city. And if that is something that is taken very badly by the Iraqis, and of course many accidents arise, because what do the people, you know, they are driving their car, they want to go to the right, to the left, the military convoy is driving quite slowly, and they are trying to pass the convoy, whatever, and accidents do arrive, and people are being killed. So the image is very bad because of that. Also, the image of just the U.S. soldier of course, they are never walking. At least, I can make the comparison with Chechnya. And believe me, the Russian soldiers are not very popular in Chechnya. But even the Russian soldiers in Chechnya are doing better in terms of image. For example, at least the Russian soldiers, they do walk sometimes. They are not only driving or on the, how do you call those military cars, the APCs. Well, at least they can walk, but in Iraq they never walk, never, and so it sort of makes a big distance between them and the population. Their image is that they are very, very far from the population, and that is something that is making the Iraqis very sad. Very sad. Of course, they are making jokes of it, but first of all, it makes them very sad. And then, of course, there is the understanding of the Iraqis is that what comes from America in terms of values, in terms of cultural values, is bad. It's something that is very, very far from their own culture. It's again, that's what they see on TV. And that is something very scary, because what they see on TV, they think it's the reality in the United States or in Western Europe. For example, the soap operas or that kind of movies, they think that's the real world in the West. And of course, that gives a terrible, very bad image of the West inside the Arab world.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, award-winning journalist and author Anne Neva. She is the author of The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question for our guest, with a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I have some related questions for you, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
How do people, if we can generalize, and I know that one of the things that struck me about the people in the wake of war is they're all individuals, but can we generalize a bit and say what can you say about how the intentions of the U.S. are viewed? How do people see our professed desire for democratic values, and what is the thinking about the current debate here about how we should proceed, if we should proceed in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about democracy in Iraq and about democratic values, the local people are very uncomfortable with this word, and with those democratic values, because what they see of the democracy, the so-called democracy that they should have and they should install, is only chaos. And we have to understand that here in the West. It's not because they are against democracy and the democratic system. It's just because what they see of it is, to their point of view, negative. Because for them, the so-called democracy, as we wanted to impose on them, is corruption, military occupation, insecurity, that's very important. None of those people, I mean, the majority of the people, the Iraqis, none of them would like to go back to the former Saddam regime. It's exactly as in Afghanistan, where I also spend a lot of time. None of them would like to go back to the Taliban's regime. But what people realize now is that what they lost in losing the dictators is that they lost the security. And that is something, of course, very important. And of course, it's not very pleasant for the West to hear. But we must understand that, because and we must also understand that it doesn't mean that they are against and that we have to try to build this democratic system in a different way. And I think the way we started, which was to impose democracy by military means, of course, gives a terrible image of democracy, and almost it's almost a paradox. And people, local people, cannot understand that. That's the first thing. Now, regarding the debate in the West, in the U.S., and the U.S. intention, well, I think no one in Iraq today has illusion anymore. Now it's difficult to say, of course, what is the consequence of what? What was first? You know, because now it's a terrible sectarian chaos in Iraq and the civilian war. But you know, a lot of people in Iraq will tell you, you know, yes, civilian war, and it will be. People say it will be even worse if the Americans leave. But no, in fact, no, because we already have the civil war. Now, and the civil war started with the U.S. occupation, or so-called liberation. It depends, you know, what can to whom you are talking to. It can be seen as a liberation or as an occupation. But the result is the same. The result is that people want only one thing, like everyone everywhere. They want to live in peace. They want their children to be able to go to school, to be able to get an instruction. They want themselves to be able to walk, and that is now absolutely not possible in Iraq. Nor is it possible, I would say, in Afghanistan and in Chechnya. But Chechnya is another case. But it's the same. I mean, and people have the same dreams and the same thing they want. They want just to live in peace. Now, how to achieve this peace is, of course, very complicated because of the pro-American Iraqi government that rules from the green zone and not really much outside, and because of the sectarian violence that has been engendered by the occupation and by the existence of the pro-American Iraqi government. But this opposition and this military opposition would also be active without that. So the problem is that there is no much will to understand each other from both sides, or a big misunderstanding. And that is something that is making, as usual, making suffering all the people who are in between, as usual, the civilians. People who are not engaged in the military, sort of paramilitaries or jihadi groups, etc., nor on the other side, on the pro-government organizations. The big majority of the Iraqi people.
You know, I've seen this figure from time to time in recent years. In here it is. In the wars of the 1990s and into the new century, between 75% and 90% of the dead and dislocated civilians.
Of course, civilians. Civilians are the primal, the first victims of any war. Any war. We talk about our soldiers dead there, then. Of course, but soldiers, that's a war. I mean, for us, a war is just a virtual war, a war that we see, we watch on our TV screens, but a war is for real. And at a war, you die. That's a possibility to die during a war when you are a soldier. But what we miss, what we forget, is that nowadays, during wars, of course, I've noticed that during my traveling, during my war coverage, I'm always on the side of the civilians. I did that in Chechnya, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. That's always, for me, the most important, is trying to understand how do they cope? How do they cope? And how can they, what do they want? How can they sort of participate, make do something, influence the process of the war, of the peace building process? And unfortunately, civilians are completely caught in between. And who asked them for their opinion? No one, of course, no one. So we speak about, casualties, but we never know exactly the numbers. We never know. For Chechnya, we will never know. But in Chechnya, it's by hundreds of thousands the victims of this war in Chechnya, the civilian victims, of course. And that's something that is almost never taken into account. And the people who do the war, who think the war, should now have real solutions for the civilians. Because if we don't think about the civilians right now, we will not stop those kind of new wars will never be ended without a real clear approach towards the civilians.
Why isn't there more reporting about the impact of war on civilians?
Because it's easier to report on everything else. To report on a war is difficult. It's very difficult for any journalist. It's difficult to report. It's difficult. And I'm not ashamed to say that sometimes I remember when I was starting my job as a war reporter in Chechnya, and I myself was in the middle of something that was happening, and I didn't know what was happening. And how can you explain it when you don't understand it? How can you describe it? How can you find the words? How can you? It's not only technologically. How do you send your story? It's just how do you apprehend it? How do you convey it? That's very difficult, and it's difficult because a war is complicated. Because when you are among the civilians, it's very complicated to you. Nothing is black and white. Nothing is for sure. Nothing is for granted. It's full of nuances. And my idea is to sort of try to grasp those nuances, and as you said, I'm very much into the details. The details, I'm not into the black and white. I'm into the 1,000 and more nuances of gray between the black and white, because every civilian has something to say, has his point of view about the war that he is enduring. Everyone, and that voice, everyone's voice is interesting to me to hear.
One of the interesting voices is a fellow by the name of Brother Yusuf, who you met in Baghdad. He's an Assyrian Christian monk.
Yes.
Interesting man.
Yes, he's a very interesting man because he's a Christian, as you say. He's Iraqi. He's Arab. And very intelligent, very smart man, and he told me many things about he suffers himself from living in Baghdad and living and seeing all the Arabs just killing themselves, killing each other, and but at the same time he understands the Western mentality because he travels to the West quite often. But he is from this world, so he can. I remember what he said about the fact that I don't remember his words now, but it was very strong. Something like, when someone is sick and someone has pain. He will cry. He will feel bad because of this pain. But if someone else doesn't feel his pain, doesn't understand that this one is in pain, doesn't hear his pain, then the man who is in pain, he will take radical measures, such as, for example, killing himself. He was trying to explain to me the reason for the people who kill themselves. in order to commit terroristic acts. And he was trying to explain that by the absence of not only attention from us, from the West, to what's happening, really happening in Iraq or in Afghanistan, but also the lack of understanding, the real lack of understanding, which leads to that kind of ultimate violence.
Yeah. He told you that there's total incomprehension.
Yes.
Between the two worlds.
Total incomprehension, absolutely. And that is, to me, what is the more saddening in my job, in fact, because I am myself sort of surfing in between the two worlds. I am surfing on the wave, and sometimes I'm on their side, then I'm back on our side, etc. And I am not pessimistic. I always think that dialogue is possible, which actually I showed myself by going there, being always, and I insist on that, always accepted everywhere I was with not only hospitality but immense generosity. So on an individual level, by showing myself my openness, my desire to learn, to hear their story, I could get some sincere answers and opinions that are, I think, important for us to hear in order to not let this gap growing. Because if we let this gap growing, we will only get more and more of what we don't want to have, which is, for example, what happened on September 11.
Everybody throwing bombs at one another.
Of course, because it won't stop. I don't see any reason for which it would stop. I mean, there is such an aggressivity from some of them, and so many possibilities for them to express this aggressivity, unfortunately. So it will continue.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope we will take from these stories? What do you hope we will do with this information?
Well, what I hope is that my reader, someone who is curious enough to open this book, read the stories, get completely into it. I expect nothing but consideration. I mean, I expect curiosity. I expect that we in the West should be closer to what we don't know. We should be not afraid of what we don't know, of this world which seems so far away, so alien to us. Everything I'm doing, all these stories, is just to make them closer to us. And I think by that, by hearing the stories and by having lived a little bit with them, because we're not scared by what we know a little bit better. And if we know a little bit better and we are not scared, we will have more desire to know more and to continue and to engage a dialogue. And I think that's exactly what we miss, and especially in the U.S., this sort of insularity, the fact that, of course, in Europe, Iraq and Afghanistan, we're closer to Iraq and to in Europe, we're closer to Iraq and Afghanistan. But in the U.S., and I know the U.S. quite well, and I myself, I am sad when I come back to the U.S. and I feel that once again, there is less curiosity for that kind of topics, for that kind of issues, because of this impression, this feeling that it's what can we do, and they are all this amalgam, this terrible assumption, terrible thing to say that, you know, in everyone who is an Arab equal Muslim equal terrorist, which is also made in Europe, of course, that is something terrible. And what I'm doing on my at my level is just fighting against that. No, not every Arab and Muslim is a terrorist. Absolutely not. And if among them there are some, yes, of course there are some, but I went there to talk to them, to those who are not terrorists, and who sometimes have do understand why they can become terrorists, why some of them do become terrorists, and why they themselves didn't become terrorists. But I think we have to hear that. We have to hear their pain, their opinion, which is most of them they are in pain because of this feeling of absence, total absence of mutual understanding. Mm. Despite the mutual sort of attraction, because of course in the Arab world, people are very attracted to the West and to the Western way of life. So it's very ambiguous, their relationship to the West.
Anne, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Anne Neva is a journalist and award-winning author. She is the author of The Wake of War, Encounters with the People of Iraq and Afghanistan. The book is now available in paperback from the Beacon Press.